Chapter 33. Bolstering Frank Capel's claim of the affair between Bobby and Marilyn was a startling piece of evidence discovered in 2016 among JFK files released by the U.S. government. It was a mid-year 1960 letter from JFK's younger sister, Jean Kennedy Smith, who died in 2020 at age 92, to Marilyn, found in Monroe's belongings at her home. It read, "Understand you and Bobby are the new item. We all think you should come with him when he comes back east." Through the years, the letter has been discounted, even to the point that it was forged, but apparently Kennedy Smith acknowledged writing it, although she said the line, "Understand that you and Bobby are the new item," was made in jest. In addition, the full content of the letter before that statement reads, "Mother asked me to write and thank you for your sweet note to Daddy. He really enjoyed it, and you are very cute to send it." Following the text regarding the new item is the closing, "Again, thanks for the note. Love, Jean Smith." Author's note: one must wonder why and what message Marilyn had sent to Joe Kennedy. It has never been revealed. Kennedy Smith, choosing the words "the new item," recalls Dorothy Kilgallen's words when she wrote a column that led with, "Marilyn Monroe's health is improving," before adding, "And she's cooking in the sex appeal department, too. She's proven vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio was in his heyday." Common sense, as noted, indicates that Kilgallen must have been referring to RFK, which connects to Kennedy Smith's proclamation that she and Bobby are the new item. Kennedy Smith, even though she appears to have denied it, believed RFK and Marilyn were the new item, with the term meaning two people who are having a romantic or sexual relationship. There are no qualifying words to her proclamation explaining it was written in jest or for any other purpose, and thus what she wrote is arguably the most significant, the most credible, and the best primary source account available to historians when taking into account those blasting Capella's book by the Kennedy family and authors through the years. This is especially true of ones writing whitewashed biographies of the Attorney General, including those who dismissed Capel's account and similar ones professing that RFK and Marilyn had an ongoing love affair when she died. One note of interest about the letter many have failed to recognize is the addition of the exclamation mark after "item" in the sentence reading, "Understand you and Bobby are the new item." Also, Kennedy Smith did not write "a new item," but "the new item," adding credibility to her message to Marilyn by making a big deal of what she had learned, arguably from family member Peter Lawford. Since Kilgallen was a stickler for details for what many might call obscure facts, the bet is that if she had known about the letter, she would have noticed the exclamation mark and "the" in front of "new item" as significant toward the legitimacy that the affair between Bobby and Marilyn was ongoing. Also, instead of having written a letter objecting to the relationship, Kennedy Smith seemed on board with it. A strong indication that the Attorney General and the famous movie star were discussing serious issues stems from an FBI memorandum dated 3-6-1962, 5 months before Marilyn died, and secured by this author through the Freedom of Information Act. The subject line reads, "Marilyn Monroe," and the text begins with, "The source advised that Marilyn Monroe, the movie actress, was recently in Mexico on vacation, and while in Mexico associated closely with certain members of the American Communist Group in Mexico, ACGM. After detailing more information about the meeting, the sixth paragraph read, "The subject, Monroe, was much disturbed by Arthur Miller's marriage on 2-20-62 and feels like a negated sex symbol." This disturbing description of Marilyn's psyche at the time, by whoever had this opinion, foreshadows how she must have felt heading into the relationships with both John and Robert Kennedy. If so, how she was treated would have ultimately exacerbated the negated sex symbol opinion of herself for certain. The next sentence then read, Subject reportedly spent some time with Robert Kennedy at the home of the Peter Lawfords in Hollywood. Subject reportedly challenged Mr. Kennedy on some points proposed to her by Arthur Miller. No explanation is offered as to what points these were, but the indication was that early in the relationship, Marilyn was discussing serious subjects with RFK, since she reportedly challenged Mr. Kennedy, Bobby, on some points proposed to her by Miller, who was, after all, a very serious man. This confirms that not only were the pair the new item, but that RFK respected her intellect as well. Those who apparently read the memo, created within 6 months of Marilyn's death, notably included Clyde Tolson, J. Edgar Hoover's right-hand man and lover. In addition to the reliable accounts of the affair recalled by Marilyn's Fox studio maid, Hazel Washington, and implied in Kilgallen's columns, a little-noticed description of the relationship appears in a book written by Fred Lawrence Giles entitled Norma Jean, The Life of Marilyn Monroe. It became a bestseller and was translated into 14 languages, with various reviews calling it a plain-speaking book, the source in every respectable book about the darling girl. This particular book by Giles, a Hollywood playwright whose tireless research dictates that his powers of recollection may be taken quite seriously, was issued through the respected publisher McGraw-Hill in 1969, 7 years after Marilyn died, and was the third book Giles wrote about her life and times and her death. The first was Goodbye Norma Jean in 1963, followed by The Final Summer of Marilyn Monroe in 1967, all within a decade of her demise. Similar to Capel, Giles relied on primary sources, unlike so many authors have done 20 years or more since Marilyn's death. Like Kilgallen, present in Dallas at the Jack Ruby trial, Capel and Giles were investigating and writing soon after Marilyn passed away, lending greater credibility to their accounts. Giles's credibility increases further in view of his having published several other well-received books, including biographies of actress Marion Davies, William Randolph Hearst's mistress, actor Tyrone Power, whom Kilgallen dated for a time, actress Joan Crawford, a friend of Marilyn's and Dorothy's, actress Jane Fonda, and comedian Stan Laurel of Laurel and Hardy fame. According to the acknowledgments, Giles's interview strategy was impressive. He wrote, "This work is a close collaboration between the author and a number of persons close to Marilyn Monroe at various critical points in her life. Among those who volunteered to go beyond the initial interview and review phases of the book itself, out of deep interest in the subject and in behalf of accuracy, were James Doherty, Arthur Miller, Ralph Roberts, Alan Snyder, and Frank and Nan Taylor." While the final three names are not as prominent in Marilyn Monroe lore, Giles is interviewing primary sources Doherty and Miller, two of Marilyn's husbands, and Roberts, her masseur since 1959, provided credibility for the author's research, since each reviewed phases of the book in behalf of accuracy. In addition, the acknowledgments included Marilyn's directors John Huston, Joshua Logan, Otto Preminger, and Billy Wilder, publicists Pat Newcomb and John Springer, and actress Lauren Bacall. Of these, Newcomb was the plum, since she knew Marilyn so well during the last days of her life. Besides credible accounts of events from Marilyn's birth through her death, what Giles wrote about her becomes especially relevant in the proof it provides that she had more than a passing dalliance with Robert Kennedy. For whatever reason, either threats of a physical nature or threats of litigation, Giles did not mention the Attorney General by name, but close scrutiny of the author's research leaves little doubt he is writing about Marilyn and RFK. Giles states in the opening to Chapter 7, "Early that summer, 1962, many were quick to say that Marilyn was through, that her career was in a steep decline. They were wrong." He then explains that in previous times when things were going south, Marilyn had chosen to be alone to reassess her life and to recover her strength. At page 341, Giles presents the first clue about the RFK-Marilyn relationship. He wrote, "This time she preferred privacy because she was involved with a married man," adding, "He was not in the movie industry. He was an Easterner with few ties on the West Coast. He had come west to work out the details of a film production of a literary property in which he had had a hand, and to escape the pressures of his work as a lawyer and public servant." Reading between the lines points to Robert Kennedy, who was not in the movie industry, one with few ties on the coast, who had come west to work on a film production of a literary property, RFK's book The Enemy Within, confirmed by other accounts, and a man who was escaping the pressures of his work as a lawyer and public servant. Bobby was Attorney General. Having whetted the appetite of readers, Giles then confirms the link between the Easterner and Marilyn, writing, "If anyone was to blame for the relationship that developed during his California stay, it was his host, who was connected to films and knew enough to realize how vulnerable and exposed she was that summer." This is obviously a reference to Peter Lawford, husband of Pat Kennedy. Giles then describes the mindset of the Easterner, writing, "For the attorney, his holiday on the West Coast was a lark, a vacation from his wife and children. He and Marilyn were discreet, almost never venturing beyond the stuccoed wall surrounding his friend's beach house," a solid reference to Lawford's Malibu home. Regarding reaction from those who knew of the affair, Giles reported, "The alliance was shocking to those who were in daily contact with Marilyn. He explained that many of her friends were worried about her close ties to the Easterner because their relationship had nowhere to go. Publicity about the affair might destroy all his chances for an important political career," another strong indication Giles was writing about RFK. Concerning the intensity of the Marilyn-RFK affair, Giles claimed the twosome were nearly constant companions, a relationship interrupted only by his flights to New York or Washington when called on some business that could not be resolved over the telephone. Placing blame on the Easterner for his involvement in Marilyn's life, Giles wrote, "If Marilyn's new friend had been free of family obligations, he might have filled admirably the void in her personal life. But he only served to deepen her anxieties while temporarily relieving her sense of feeling unwanted." This feeling of being unwanted came despite, as Giles stated, Marilyn commanding up to $1 million per movie when her Fox contract expired. Relevant to the letter that JFK's younger sister, Jean Kennedy Smith, wrote to Marilyn, Giles reported, "A letter discovered after Marilyn's death from Robert Kennedy's sister in the East made clear to Marilyn that she, the sister, and most of the family would welcome her if she came east with her brother." Giles does not provide details as to why Kennedy Smith felt this way or why he added "most of the family" to the equation, unless he believed Kennedy Smith was speaking for the family, but he added a bit of melodrama to the account, writing, "Even this letter must have failed to take away Marilyn's sense that she had blundered into an affair that could only end badly." After noting Marilyn's war of words with Fox and efforts to resolve the dispute surrounding the film Something's Got to Give, Giles wrote, "Marilyn continued to see her summer friend, but she had no peace of mind. Her ego was badly bruised, her belief in herself was profoundly shaken, and sleep eluded her. And there was that man, phoning Marilyn he was back in town and asking if she would come by for a drink and maybe dinner." Returning to his mention of the host, certainly Lawford, Giles added he was, in Marilyn's view, acting as a buffer between them and those forces antagonistic to their affair. She was beginning to see the hopelessness of her alliance. Still, a phone call from him, the Easterner, would alter whatever else she had planned for the evening, and she would go to him. Giles then draws on his primary sources to inspect how Joe DiMaggio fit in with her life at this time, July 1962, 1 month before she died. The author wrote, "Joe was on the phone with her almost every day. He was now her staunchest ally in a world gone sour. In July, when word reached DiMaggio of her interest in the Easterner, they had a bad row. He had reason to be alarmed and angry. Giles then added that Marilyn had written the famous ball player to the effect that if she could make him happy, she would have succeeded in the biggest and most difficult thing she could imagine, that of making one person completely happy. She concluded by informing him that his happiness meant her happiness. Unfortunately, for Marilyn's sake, Giles reported that the letter was unsigned and never sent, but later discovered in her desk. Then, in a shocking statement, he wrote, "Word reached at least one member of Arthur Jacobs's press staff that Marilyn feared she was pregnant. Confirmation of the fact is hard to pin down." Author's note, Jacobs not only represented Marilyn, but also Gregory Peck, James Stewart, and Judy Garland. During the years since Marilyn died, so-called experts have perpetuated the idea that Marilyn was pregnant with RFK's child. However, based on this author's research, there appears to be no documented evidence of this being true, including hospital records or what happened if she was pregnant. In none of his books about Marilyn does Giles provide any proof of the pregnancy. Thus, his account cannot be factored into any motive for her death. Regardless, Giles's account of the relationship between Marilyn and the Easterner is valuable in assessing whether Marilyn had blundered into an affair that could only end badly. Giles never mentioned how the affair ended, but he blamed it on the Easterner, who, Giles believed, likely toiled with Marilyn's emotions, making promises about leaving his wife and children and marrying the famous actress when he knew such was impossible. Persons close to Marilyn who didn't believe her death was suicide included Masseur Ralph Roberts, interviewed by Giles, who had a bit part in the movie The Misfits during a scene where it shows her concern for a rodeo rider, Montgomery Clift, that won't give up getting the ring despite lingering injuries. In a YouTube interview, Roberts spoke of how he was walking down Rodeo Drive with Marilyn when she was recognized, and the whole world stopped. It was like some big Technicolor spectacular. As her masseur, Roberts stated that he got many calls from Marilyn at any time of the day or night because we had that kind of friendship, and she had found that when all else failed, if she had a massage, especially if I massaged her feet, she would fall asleep. Apparently, he knew that she had taken delivery of flowers and plants from a nursery at 4 o'clock p.m. on August 4th, and with that in mind, and the fact that this was her first owned home after more than 40 rentals, he said, "That last weekend, I think she was in better shape than all those years I had been around, and she was very excited about having her own house. I remember her saying, 'It's so good laughing again.'" Roberts, from whom Marilyn may have been hiding her inner turmoil, recalled that he called her at 6 o'clock p.m. on the fourth day, only to be abruptly told that "she's not home, and not that she is busy," by Dr. Greenson. This disturbed Roberts, who said that if Greenson had said she was busy, it would be easier to believe that Marilyn committed suicide, but he closed by stating, "I think somebody done her in." Whether it was RFK who done her in directly or peripherally, his keeping her emotions in an unstable state may very well have contributed to her eventual demise. This is true, especially since, as Giles surmised, Marilyn was in such a vulnerable state of mind during those fateful months of July and early August 1962, even though her career was on the upswing. After she died, headliner columnist Hedda Hopper spoke of Marilyn's death in a curious manner, stating, according to author Edwin Hoyt, "In a way, we are all guilty. We built her up to the skies. We loved her, but left her lonely and afraid when she needed us most." A reference, it would seem, to the same vulnerability author Giles mentions, while not specifying what Marilyn, the world's number one movie box office star, may have been afraid of. 2 months before Marilyn died, she had posed for Life magazine photographer Bert Stern. He called it an unforgettable encounter, but unfortunately Marilyn died before the issue was published. The photo session was conducted in a suite at the Hotel Bel Air in Beverly Hills. To impart a relaxing mood, Stern brought along Marilyn's favorite champagne, Dom Perignon 1953, and a stack of Everly Brothers records. His goal? I wanted her in a space made up of light, a clear nowhere. When she arrived, late, of course, he later said, "It was the girl next door, the girl every man dreams of, walking slowly toward me in the golden light." Marilyn was in a delightful mood, Stern said, and when he told her, "You're beautiful," she responded in a rather shy manner, telling him, "Oh, really, what a nice thing to say." Besides confirming Marilyn to be in the best of spirits at the time, Stern was proud of a photo where she sips champagne while wrapped in a white sheet. One observation, he added, "Her skin was as fine and translucent as real silk. It had the faintest aura of gold down on it, like a peach." At the end of the session, Stern recalled, "I stood there like a dazed lover, believing that Marilyn had the power. She was light and the goddess and the moon, the space and the dream, the mystery and the danger." In effect, then, RFK was the only dark cloud circling her as the days counted down to her death, especially since on the very afternoon before she died, Giles pointed to the reason for Robert's attempting to reach Marilyn. This dealt with the positive reactions to an interview with Richard Merriman of Life magazine based on a taped interview series earlier that summer. Part of the interview, which Kilgallen could have been aware of, read, "Talent is developed in privacy, you know, and it's really true. There is a need for aloneness which I don't think most people realize for an actor. It's almost having certain kinds of secrets for yourself that you'll let the whole world in for a moment when you're acting, but everybody is always tugging at you. They'd all like to take a chunk of you. They kind of like to take pieces of you. I don't think they realize it, but it's like, do this, do that. But you want to stay intact, intact and on 2 feet." Continuing to answer Merriman's questions, Marilyn replied, "But when you're famous, you run into human nature in a raw kind of way. It stirs up envy, fame does. People you run into feel that, well, who is she? Who does she think she is, Marilyn Monroe?" Her parting comment on this subject was, "But fame is not really for a daily diet. That's not what fills you. It warms you a bit, but warming is temporary. It's like caviar, you know? It's good to have caviar, but not when you have it every meal and every day." Author Edwin Hoyt had another perspective. He wrote, "These were Marilyn's expressed philosophies, the character she had lived these 36 years, 2 months, and 3 days. They had very little to do with the Marilyn that was on the silver screen." Regarding reaction to the Life magazine interview, Giles wrote, "Marilyn had been receiving calls for 2 days congratulating her about the interview's candor. She was delighted to know that her friends, those who really counted with her, found it a fairly accurate portrait since, as she said, I wanted it to come out as me." Roberts, Giles said, was calling Marilyn to congratulate her as well, but Dr. Greenson stopped him from speaking to her. Why this happened is unclear. Just as Dorothy Kilgallen had appeared quite normal on her final What's My Line program hours before her death, prompting moderator John Daly to say, "Dorothy was just full of beans last night. She was in great spirits." The accounts from Joe DiMaggio Jr., Joe Sr.'s only child with first wife actress Dorothy Arnold, and her friend Jean Carmen offered no reason for alarm about Marilyn's condition. Each said later they believed she was not under the influence of drugs or in any depressed state of mind. Any proper investigation of Marilyn's death would have taken into consideration accounts like these from Roberts and those at Fox who were looking forward to working with the new Marilyn, the happy Marilyn, the one looking toward the future. But these eyewitnesses were left out of any accounts about Marilyn's psyche just before she died. just as were so many who could have spoken about Kilgallen being at the top of her career with much to live for before she died. Tracing Dorothy Kilgallen's movements during the hours leading up to her death and the means by which she was murdered may be done with certainty, but doing so, as noted, during the last hours of Marilyn Monroe's life before she died, presents a strong challenge. So many different accounts exist, but one particular scenario with significant historical importance appears quite credible based on this author's extensive new research when considering her death for the first time in the context of both the JFK assassination and Kilgallen's remarks about Marilyn just prior to and right after her demise. Before considering that scenario, however, it makes sense to take advantage of the ability to look into the world Marilyn lived in just before she died. Such is possible by examining the pages of a book of telephone numbers the famous movie star had in her possession on August 4, 1962. A copy was purchased by this author in mid-2020. Including mostly typed information, one page in the book discloses the telephone numbers for both Joe DiMaggio and Joe DiMaggio Jr. Entries in the phone book also include Family, Bernice Miracle, Gainesville, Florida, Franklin 20584, Close Friends, Peter Lawford, 625 Ocean Front, Santa Monica, California, GL1 1800. Frank Sinatra. 6 telephone numbers, including studio dressing room. HO96246. Joe P. DiMaggio. San Francisco Restaurant. Ordway 32266. Joe DiMaggio Jr. New Haven, Connecticut. OL61029. Joe DiMaggio. Private. PL97279. Florida, JA45551. Arthur Miller, Congress 33500, Hotel Chelsea, 222 West 23rd Street, New York. Private line, WS44467. Yves Montand, Paris address and phone. Producers, directors, acting coaches, attorney. John Huston, St. Clarence, Crawwell, County Galway, Ireland. Lochray 53 or 54. Nunnally Johnson, Flat 6, 33 Grosvenor Square, London, WI. George Cukor, CR14418. Mickey Rudin, JP34863. David Selznick, CR15727. Spiros Skouras, CO5-3320. Jerry Wald, producer, CR6-6074. Lee and Paula Strasberg, private classes, JU6-4800. Actors Studio, PLO-870. Movie Stars: Jane Russell, ST9-0764. Jack Benny, CR6-3808. Monty, Montgomery, Clift, OX79287. Henry Fonda, RH44839. Rex Harrison, EX54270. Gene Kelly, 725 North Rodeo Drive, Beverly Hills. Jack Lemon, GR44095. Dinah Shore Montgomery, CR46727. Shelley Winters, CR14094. Columnists: Hedda Hopper, Home, CR69428, Office, HO93686, Ann Landers, TH54623, Luella Parsons, Columnist, CR14222. Also included were Marilyn's home and personal health team. Dr. Ralph Greenson, 436 North Roxbury Drive, Beverly Hills, CR 1-4050. Home, 902 Franklin, Santa Monica. GR 3-2900. Dr. Herman Engelberg, 9730 Wilshire Boulevard, Beverly Hills. CR 5-4366. Home, CR 5-1458. Pat Newcomb, CR 6-4275. Hazel Washington, Mrs. Rocky, CA 1-3583. 240 South Avenue, 19 Los Angeles, 31. Office, Los Angeles Police Department, CL 6-2254. Eunice Murray, DU 4-6113. Two other numbers. Ralph Roberts, CR 3-2563. Miscellaneous contacts included Lily Dache, Hair, NYC. Carpet and Linoleum, American Airlines. Dermatologist, Shoe Store, Beverly Hills Hotel, Chateau Marmont. Dressmaker, Dentists, Eye Doctor, Bank, Florists. List of 6 California hotels, List of 6 New York hotels, Kennels, Limousine Service, NBC, Plumber, Painter, Plants, Perfume, Saks Fifth Avenue, and Yellow Cab. Noticeably absent in the phone book are the names of Dorothy Kilgallen and, of course, John and Robert Kennedy. Frank Sinatra is prominently listed, as is Peter Lawford, Marilyn's connection to the Kennedys. The number for Bernice Miracle, her half-sister, is also displayed. One curious matter remains unsolved despite this author's research. The LAPD's listing alongside Marilyn's studio maid, Hazel Washington. Of additional interest is the inclusion of the phone number for producer Jerry Wald. He was the same producer Robert Kennedy met with about the film version of RFK's book, The Enemy Within, when the Attorney General was in Los Angeles. It may be recalled that author Frank Capel chronicled what he believed happened during the days and hours before and after Marilyn Monroe died. Adding to this author's account are additional facts gathered from various other sources, each to be weighed regarding their authenticity. Of certain interest are reports surfacing that, after Marilyn's funeral, her friend and confidant, Pat Newcomb, was seen at the Kennedy compound at Hyannisport, Massachusetts. She then left the country, visiting Switzerland, Holland, Germany, and France before returning to the U.S. months later. That trip has never been fully explained, but points to the possibility she entered the Kennedy clan headquarters so as to be managed regarding what she said about Marilyn's death and, more importantly, about her relationship with both JFK and Bobby. An application for federal employment was also apparently filed by Newcomb on October 10, 1963, more than a year after Marilyn died. Listed among 3 references are Mr. and Mrs. Peter Lawford. Further details have emerged about what may have happened before Newcomb arrived at Marilyn's death scene. These details appeared when LAPD Sergeant Jack Clemens, a 15-year veteran, later reported what he had seen when he arrived. Marilyn was lying face down in a soldier's position, catty-cornered to the bed. Obviously, she had been placed in that position, and I was shown the nightstand by her bed, and there were about 8 or 10 empty bottles that had contained medicine, barbiturates. Dr. Greenson said she must have swallowed them all. I looked in the bathroom for a glass or a half-empty glass, and there was none. There was no suicide note, and all we had was some empty bottles. Clemens's conclusion? Marilyn Monroe was murdered. Commenting on Clemens's observations and other aspects of Marilyn's death, former South Carolina forensics expert Troy Vaughn, mentioned before, told this author, "The coroner's report stated that Marilyn's death was due to a massive dose of 47 Nembutal capsules, but there was no trace of drugs in her stomach or evidence of her having taken the tablets orally." Later, Sergeant Clemens claimed that, "It looked as if her body had been posed on the bed, legs stretched out perfectly straight, Unlike the contorted bodies of most victims who have overdosed on sleeping tablets. Vaughn added, also, key forensic evidence went missing shortly after she died. All the key witnesses from that night, police, friends, a psychiatrist, an attorney, her press agent, etc., contradict each other, and several changed their stories. In several other interviews, Clemens explained he was surprised that Marilyn's bed, when he arrived, was in order, and especially curious as to why the washing machine was running at just before 5 o'clock a.m. Specifically, he was quoted as saying that everything had been arranged in neat order on the bed and the body deliberately positioned. It all looked too tidy. Clemens's and Vaughn's belief that the death scene had been disturbed certainly coincides with how Dorothy Kilgallen's death scene was likewise staged. Interestingly enough, the famous reporter would have certainly wondered about the case report created by Dr. Noguchi on August 5th, especially since there is the notation regarding cause of death which reads, Barb's overdose, with, again, no suggestion of suicide. While there is no way to tell what Noguchi based this conclusion on, whether it was his seeing several empty pill bottles, speaking with Dr. Engelberg or Dr. Greenson, either of whom could have told him of their belief that she overdosed, or another source, it is quite significant that Dr. Noguchi did not consider suicide, a determination missed by many authors who have written about Marilyn's death. Since Noguchi would later agree that she died of a probable suicide, one must wonder what changed his mind, or whether his mind was changed for him by higher-ups in the medical examiner's office or the police department. But the fact remains that the deputy medical examiner, arguably one with little experience, never considered any possibility of suicide when he first considered the cause of Marilyn's death. Of additional interest in the case report is the remarks section. Noguchi, in his own handwriting, reported, obtained the following from Guy Haskett, Westwood Village Mortuary. Deceased was found at approximately 3:05 a.m. by housekeeper Eunice Murray, who got up to check on deceased, and she found the bedroom door locked. She called Dr. Engelberg, who came over immediately. The doctor took the poker from the fireplace and broke the bedroom window to gain admittance. Of significance, when determining the truth about what happened when Marilyn died, one must compare Noguchi's remarks account in his case report with the police report mentioned in Frank Capella's book, The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe, as previously mentioned, and a follow-up police report. First, recall Capel's summary of the police report. He wrote, in part, according to the police report, Marilyn had retired at about 8 o'clock p.m. on Saturday, August 4, 1962. This information was given to them by Marilyn's housekeeper, Mrs. Eunice Murray. She stated she saw a light under the door in Marilyn's room at 12 o'clock midnight, but went to bed. At 3:30 a.m., she looked again and saw the light under the door. The door was locked, so she walked around and looked in the bedroom window. She said she saw Marilyn lying in bed on her stomach with the phone receiver in her hand. She stated she called Marilyn's psychiatrist and he told her to call Dr. Engelberg, which she did. Dr. Greenson arrived at 3:40 a.m. He stated that he broke the window pane in the bedroom window. He entered through the window, removed the telephone from her hand, and found her probably dead. Rigor mortis had already set in. This report is based on interviews with both Eunice Murray and Dr. Greenson, but there are no quotes from Dr. Engelberg. Next up is the follow-up report prepared by the Los Angeles Police Department and signed by R.E. Byron, badge number 2730. As would be the case in a court of law, this document, prepared on 8-6-62, one day after Noguchi's case report and 2 days after Marilyn died, speaks for itself. One does not have to be a seasoned homicide detective to realize that confusion reigns when considering the fact that Eunice Murray is quoted in Noguchi's case report as telling Guy Haskett from the mortuary that she called Dr. Engelberg, who came over immediately. The doctor took the poker from the fireplace and broke the bedroom window to gain admittance, which conflicts with Murray being quoted in the police report. She stated she called Marilyn's psychiatrist, Greenson, and he told her to call Dr. Engelberg, which she did. In addition, while the case report states, "The doctor, Engelberg, took the poker from the fireplace and broke the bedroom window to gain admittance," the police report provides this statement from Marilyn's psychiatrist. "Dr. Greenson arrived at 3:40 a.m. He stated that he broke the window pane in the bedroom window." When the two reports are then compared with the follow-up report, notice the wording. "Dr. Greenson received a phone call from Mrs. Murray, reporting person, at 3:30 a.m., 8:562, stating that she was unable to get into Miss Monroe's bedroom and the light was on." A few sentences later are the words, "He, Dr. Greenson, also told Mrs. Murray to call Dr. Engelberg," and, "Dr. Greenson arrived at deceased house at about 3:40 a.m. He broke the window pane and entered through that window and removed the phone from her hand. Then, apparently, Dr. Engelberg arrived at 3:50 a.m. and pronounced Marilyn dead." Regarding the latter report, notice the first paragraph, which states, "Upon re-interviewing both Dr. Ralph P. Greenson, wit number 1, and Dr. Hyman Engelberg, wit number 2, they both agree to the following time sequence of their actions." One may quibble about the time differences provided, but the main questions to be asked are, who is lying and who is telling the truth among Murray, Engelberg, and Greenson according to the three reports? That Greenson and Engelberg were re-interviewed on the 6th of August certainly provided the opportunity to get their stories straight, but, regardless, those stories don't coincide with the account provided by Eunice Murray. Why her account appears to be the most credible will be explained later, but suffice it to say that logic dictates that she would have called the movie star's physician before her psychiatrist. An additional point of contention Kilgallen would have focused on in the case report is the writing under Barb's overdose, reading, "covered by a sheet and a blanket." That wording is the only reference this author can find that Marilyn was also covered by a blanket in addition to a sheet. Certainly Clemens never mentioned it, nor has anyone close to Marilyn's death, and thus why Noguchi added blanket to the mix only leads to speculation as to why, if he was correct, a blanket may have been covering Marilyn's body. Regarding the pill bottles being neatly arranged, as Sergeant Clemens later stated, the report of chemical analysis prepared by the coroner and filed from the toxicology lab in the Hall of Justice provided the list. Amazingly enough, the list included more than 100 capsules or tablets in addition to empty containers of Nebutol and Nolidar, methoprilon, used for treating insomnia at the time. Also of note is the presence of Librium, used to treat anxiety or withdrawal symptoms of alcoholism, sulfathalidine, pain relief anesthetic, Phenergan, drug used to treat allergic reactions and to treat or prevent nausea and vomiting from illness, and chloral hydrate, to be explored further. With so many drugs available to Marilyn, the potential for confusion as to which ones and how many to take seems likely. And since Noguchi's autopsy was so flawed, there is no concrete proof of what drugs were actually discovered in her system, leading to some indication that the accidental cause of death is possible if, in fact, she was not murdered. Yes, Marilyn, found nude while clutching a telephone receiver with an empty bottle of Nebutol nearby, was dead. Dead at age 36. What a sad, tragic ending for a movie star whose 23 movies had grossed more than $250 million, a huge sum during her era. Regarding the death scene, one may notice a policeman and an unidentified woman standing outside the door. More importantly, the bed area is a complete mess, confirming that the death scene had been compromised, either accidentally or on purpose. While this photo seems inconclusive, and when it was taken unknown, The blanket Noguchi apparently saw when he was there appears to be in a pile on the bed, adding to the mystery of how Marilyn really died.